So, in the age of coronavirus, how's your sex life going?
What sex life?
The beginning of the pandemic, I had sex a lot more out of boredom, but we have become less intimate, less often. Our two kiddos are at school, and my husband has been able to come home for lunch and dessert.
I'm Arun Vanagopal in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, September 3rd, we talk hooking up during the pandemic with you. Plus, even after months of protests against police brutality, some say that California's police reform bills have fallen flat. But our lead today brings us to Tulsa, where a legal push for reparations from the Black Wall Street Massacre of 1921 is happening.
They robbed us of our potential. They stripped us of our spirit. And so it is so much bigger because there's no statute of limitation on murder.
In 1921, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, an incident of racist violence took place, and its impact can still be felt today. That summer, mobs of white rioters stormed through the Greenwood neighborhood in Tulsa. It was known as Black Wall Street, and it was predominantly made up of affluent Black people. As the rioters made their way through the neighborhood, they attacked and killed members of the community. They burned buildings to the ground. Historians believe that as many as 300 people may have died. Survivors of the massacre were never compensated for their losses. But this week, nearly a century after the fact, people in Tulsa filed a lawsuit demanding reparations for victims and descendants of the Tulsa race massacre. The lawsuit is led by one of the last remaining survivors of the massacre, 105-year-old Lessie Benningfield Randall. Earlier this summer, the massacre received renewed attention when President Trump planned a campaign rally in Tulsa on Juneteenth, a day celebrating the liberation of enslaved people in the U.S. The backlash was swift for members of the community, who saw the planned rally as a slap in the face to the memory of those who'd been killed. The president moved his rally to the following day. I'm Arun Vanagopal in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we break down the fight for reparations in response to the Tulsa massacre, and how this summer's protests might influence the reparations debate moving forward. I'm joined now by William Darity, better known as Sandy. He's a professor of public policy at Duke University and co-author of From Here to Equality: Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. Hi, Sandy.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also with Tiffany Crutcher, founder of the Terrence Crutcher Foundation and descendant of a survivor from the 1921 Tulsa Massacre. Tiffany, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So tell us, Tiffany, what is the case for reparations in Tulsa?
Well, the case for reparations is simply this. Almost 100 years ago, my great-grandmother's beloved community, Greenwood, also known as Black Wall Street, was burnt to the ground by mobs of white rioters. And I'm sure you have follow-up questions, but it was never atoned for. We never received compensation, retribution, and they robbed us of our generational wealth. And here we are, almost 100 years later, fighting for those survivors, fighting for the descendants, fighting for the last known living survivor, one of the last known, Bessie Benningfield Randall, in hopes that she would see some form of justice or abatement before God calls her home.
Yeah, I mean, well, so your great-grandmother was a survivor, as you said. Can you tell us her story?
Yes, Rebecca Brown Crutcher is my father's grandmother, and shamefully, unfortunately, I didn't know she endured what she called at the time the Tulsa race riot. I left and went to college, and people would ask, where are you from? And I would tell them Tulsa, Oklahoma. And people from Chicago, LA, New York would immediately say Black Wall Street or the Tulsa race riot. And after the third time, of course, I played it off because I didn't want people to think I didn't know about my own city. I went home and I said, Dad, what are these people talking about? What are my classmates talking about? And that's when he told me about what happened to, we call her Mama Brown, Becca Brown Crutcher. She had to flee in fear of her life. She had a business on Black Wall Street, a barbecue pit, her and her family, and she jumped on the back of a truck to get out of harm's way. And as she was fleeing, I think she went off to some creek land to Muskogee, Oklahoma, which is about 40 miles east of Tulsa. She saw the burning and the killing of unarmed people. And I often stop and ponder, what was she feeling? You know, what was she thinking? What was going through her mind? And a few years later, she whispered to my dad, you know, when Martin Luther King was killed and the riots broke out all over, and she whispered to my dad, that happened here. And my dad had just got back from Vietnam. And my dad said, why are you whispering? And she said, well, they told us if we ever said anything about it, it would happen again. And that's the fear they instilled in our ancestors and those survivors and our beloved, you know, community. And so they never talked about it, which is why we never knew about it. And you'll hear that story throughout our community. They didn't teach us in middle school or high school in Oklahoma history. We learned about the Trail of Tears, but they never taught us what happened to our thriving Black community. And I played on that sacred land and didn't know I was playing on sacred ground.
Sandy, it's interesting when we still hear this term Tulsa race riot, which you know, really, I guess, annoys me. I saw in the New York Times that phrase. It seems to me to really remove the agency of the rioters, if you will, the mob of white people who acted and destroyed these businesses, killed hundreds of people. It was more like what we would refer to as a pogrom or a massacre or even ethnic cleansing. Am I right?
I prefer to use the term massacre to describe what happened in Tulsa. Unfortunately, what happened in Tulsa was one of the more extreme instances of a series of these white terror campaigns that took place across the United States from the end of the Civil War up until the 1940s, which resulted in intimidation of Black Americans, particularly intended to prevent them from participating in the political process. It resulted in the destruction or theft of their personal property, which is something that happened on an extensive basis in Tulsa, and it was accompanied by a series of outright murders of Black people. The year 1919, in particular, 2 years before the Tulsa massacre, featured upwards of 30 to 35 of these pogroms that took place both north and south in the United States, and led to that particular year's summer being referred to as the Red Summer of 1919. It's interesting that the only instance that I believe some form of restitution has actually been made is in the case of Rosewood, Florida, a massacre that took place in 1923, where the state of Florida has made some limited restitution to the victims and their descendants. But that's interesting in another way, because the state of Florida was actually one of the bloodiest states in the United States with respect to these massacres, and no restitution has been provided for the white mob violence that took place in other parts of the state.
Sandy, Tiffany referred to the loss of generational wealth, which is an idea that's really, I think, gained momentum in recent years. How do we understand, how do we quantify this loss when we're talking about reparations?
The beginning of the intergenerational loss actually starts with the deprivation of the formerly enslaved, the deprivation of the 40 acres in restitution that they were promised. At the same time, the federal government was providing 160-acre tracts of land to white families that, in quotes, settled in the western part of the United States. These tracts of land, these allocations went to upwards of 1 million white families that resulted in a situation where today 45 million living white descendants are beneficiaries of those land grants. At the same time, the formerly enslaved were given nothing. and therefore did not have an opportunity to transfer wealth across generations. The net effect is that we observe a situation today where Black Americans constitute about 13% of the nation's population, but only possess about 2.5% of the nation's wealth. This translates into an average differential across households of $800,000 in a gap in net worth between Black and white households.
That's an average, you're saying?
That's an average.
That's profound, isn't it? Tiffany, what is the racial wealth gap like in Tulsa today?
Oh, wow. Well, whites make 50% more than Blacks here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's just evident. And we make up about 15% of the population here. But if you come to Tulsa, Arun, you'll see that those same railroad tracks that divided the white side of town from the north side of town, from Black Wall Street, those same railroad tracks still symbolize the same thing today. We live in a tale of two cities. And so a child's life expectancy in North Tulsa, which is the Black side of town, is 10 years less than a child's life expectancy in another zip code. We live in a food desert. There's blight everywhere. Gentrification, Black Wall Street, 35 to 40 square blocks were burned to the ground. And now our beloved community has been reduced to one block. And the only Black-owned entity is the historic Vernon AME Church in that heart of Greenwood. And that's why we're filing lawsuit. I mean, we're not just filing for a monetary, you know, suit. We want abatement. We want for descendants of survivors to have scholarships for the next 99 years. We feel that we shouldn't have to pay utilities for the next, or taxes for the next 99 years. And we want to sue the Tulsa Development Authority and do a forensic assessment of all of the land. Because when I think about Dr. A.C. Jackson, a prominent Black doctor who was coming out of his home during the massacre, as Professor Sandy said, you know, who took over his land? Why don't we own it? Why doesn't one of his descendants, who's a part of this lawsuit, why don't they own that land? And so it's so much bigger than the monetary portion of this. I think about the descendant of J.B. Stratford. J.B. Stratford owned the nicest hotel as a Black person in the nation. Just think about what he could have become. He could have been the Hyatt Hotel. He could have been Marriott. He could have been Hilton. They robbed us of our potential, of our dreams. They stripped us of our spirit. And so it is so much bigger than the monetary. And it was the white supremacist policies and tactics and white people controlling the narrative. That's why they called it a riot, because there's a statute of limitation on riots. That was by design. And it should have been called a massacre from the beginning, because there's no statute of limitation on murder.
Sandy, we've seen the reparations debate really enter the mainstream, I think, just in the last year or so. Are you surprised?
Yes, I am surprised. And I'm somewhat taken aback and excited about the prospect of there being a serious national conversation about reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery.
Is it easier to talk about this in regard to particular episodes of violence like in Tulsa than it is to talk about it in the abstract at a national level, when we're talking about like tens of millions of people and centuries of history bearing down on the present?
So I think specific episodes of atrocities really make tangible to the American people the horrors that have been inflicted on Black Americans. But I don't think it's that difficult to really appreciate the national atrocities collectively without itemizing each individual event. And so, so what we've argued in From Here to Equality is that there are three phases of injustice that have to be taken into consideration. The first is obviously the period of slavery. The second, though, is what people do not pay as much attention to in thinking about reparations, which is nearly 100 years of legal segregation accompanied by these waves of mob violence that we've been talking about, best exemplified by what happened in Tulsa. And then the third phase is the post-Civil Rights Act period, where we have continued to have mass incarceration, ongoing police executions of unarmed blacks, the persistence of discrimination in employment, housing, and credit markets, as well as the subject that I emphasized, this enormous racial wealth disparity between blacks and whites in the United States.
So given that context, what would reparations actually look like in practice?
From the perspective that we advance and From Here to Equality, we argue that the primary objective of a reparations project would be to provide Black Americans with the material basis for full citizenship in the United States, full citizenship that's been continuously denied. And that would require eliminating in its entirety the Black-white wealth differential. So we estimate that this would require a national expense of $10 to $12 trillion. To provide adequate restitution to erase the wealth differential, that these funds should be distributed to individual eligible recipients, and the eligible community should be individuals who have an ancestral connection to chattel slavery in the United States and who are living their lives in the context of being Black in a society that has a long history of racism.
William Sandy Darity is a professor of public policy at Duke University and author of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. Tiffany Crutcher is the founder of the Terrence Crutcher Foundation and a descendant of the 1921 Tulsa Massacre. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Arun Vanigopal, in for Tanzina Vega today. Good to be with you. In early June, near the start of this summer's racial justice uprising, California Governor Gavin Newsom told demonstrators that their voices were being heard.
We have a responsibility to change. Our institutions need to change. Our capacity of understanding needs to change. We need to contextualize not only this moment, but moments in the past where we never met these calls and these cries, that we ran short. We ran long on rhetoric, short on results.
This week, California reached the end of its legislative session, and while several criminal justice bills were passed, a number of more progressive measures ultimately fell short. To get a better sense of what this round of criminal justice legislation means for the Golden State, I spoke with Marisa Lagos, politics correspondent at KQED News and co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown.
Broadly, this is an attempt to institute more oversight of police and make sure that there is sort of a public accounting when things do go wrong. One of them, the main one I would say, is AB 1506. This is something that an assemblyman from Sacramento has been trying to pass for at least 5 years. And it essentially would say that in the case of a deadly police shooting, that investigation would be taken from the agency where it happened and given either to the state attorney general or possibly to a new state agency if the attorney general doesn't want it. And the big catch here is they would need to fund that before it can go into effect. So there's some questions. There's another bill that's going to let local counties create oversight commissions for sheriffs who, you know, are elected and don't really have the same kind of oversight that we see at a lot of city police departments. And finally, they did ban chokeholds. So that was obviously a big point of contention after the George Floyd killing. And I think those were sort of That one was not as controversial as some of the other ones that did not make it through this year.
So let's talk about what you refer to as essentially the centerpiece of this raft of legislation, AB 1506. What kind of opposition were you seeing from law enforcement and their allies in recent weeks?
Well, I mean, this is something that, interestingly, I think behind the scenes, we've seen lobbying for many years around this issue and concern, particularly from unions. I mean, this is one of those interesting ones, right, where we have seen historically sometimes a split between chiefs and rank and file. But I do think that this is more of a question of prosecutors, right? And so the big split here has actually been between the question of local control. Should a local district attorney be able to, can they do an impartial and fair investigation, or does that need to be taken up to the state level where they might not have the same kind of connections and, you know, quite frankly, working relationship? I mean, I think a big question here is whether local prosecutors are kind of beholden to the police department in a way that the attorney general wouldn't. But we've also seen the last two attorney generals, Kamala Harris, now the Democratic vice presidential nominee, and Javier Becerra, who's a pretty progressive Democrat, has sued the Trump administration 100 times. They both, as attorney general, pushed back on this, saying they didn't have the resources to do these types of investigations. And so I think that that's why we ended up with this piece saying, hey, you have to fund this. And really, I think there's a longer runway in terms of when this could actually take effect because of those concerns from prosecutors. Arun, I just did some deep dives into Kamala Harris's record, and I found out that, interestingly, one of the reasons she really pushed back was that when she was first district attorney, folks threatened to take a murder case of a police officer. So a gang member had shot a police officer. She had run saying she wouldn't seek the death penalty. She did not. That angered a lot of cops. They went to the state attorney general and said, hey, take this case away. And so when she was then attorney general 8 years later, she was like, no, I don't want to be taking away this power from local elected DAs. So unlike some of the policing stuff, I think a lot of the conversation has been around the prosecutor role more even than the police department itself.
Now that these bills have been passed, what actually happens next?
Well, they are sitting on Governor Gavin Newsom's desk. You know, he did kind of come out broadly in support of sort of broad brushstrokes on police reform and then some specifics. We know, for example, that he had said that the chokehold ban should be instituted. So I would be surprised if he vetoed any of these bills, but, you know, never say never.
So you have some level of uncertainty in terms of implementing some of these measures. It's unclear right now, isn't it, the extent to which they'll actually, I guess, go forward.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this shows really the sort of sustained power of law enforcement, even in this moment of this racial uprising, and really, I think, widespread support for some of these oversight measures. You know, the police unions, the sheriff's unions, the correctional officers unions in California have historically been very powerful and had really, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, funded a lot of the tough on crime measures. I don't think they hold the same power they did 20 years ago, but there are certainly a lot of more moderate Democrats in the state legislature who don't want to kind of cross them. And I think, I mean, the other interesting thing I always think about is, for example, a sheriff is a countywide elected official. A DA is a countywide elected official. A police chief, you know, represents an entire city, essentially. Those elected officials get more votes, have more constituents than a state assembly person, right? So they do kind of come with a kind of power, I think, when they come to lobby for or against things that we don't see from all local officials.
And what else should we know that didn't make it through?
Well, there's another bill that kind of was aiming to build on a previous measure that really opened up police misconduct records at the beginning of the year and has resulted in, hundreds and hundreds of cases being opened up by folks like my colleagues at KQED and really finding some horrific evidence of misconduct. And one of the things that we found in this after this first bill passed was that a lot of police officers can get fired and then go on to be hired elsewhere. And so that plays into that certification issue I was talking about. But one of the state senators had wanted to essentially open up that open records reform even further and said it's not just certain serious incidents like sexual misconduct or a deadly shooting. They wanted any sustained instance of use of force by an officer or any instance where an officer is found to have lied to be a public record. And that one also did not make it through this year.
Now, there are some ballot measures that are going to be up before voters in November concerning criminal justice. Can you tell us what some of those measures entail?
Yeah, this is really interesting, Arun, because these are ballot measures that were put on before George Floyd's death and before a lot of these protests this summer. One of them is essentially it's a referendum on a bill that was passed 2 years ago by the legislature and signed by then Governor Jerry Brown to essentially end cash bail in California. This was put on by the bail industry. They are asking voters to reject that law. And so that's going to be a pretty big fight, one I know folks in New York are familiar with, because you guys have had these debates as well sure. as across the country, really. The other is a kind of grab bag that is being put on by a former police officer who is actually a Democratic, but a pretty moderate Democratic state assemblyman, some district attorneys and other law enforcement. And it seeks to roll back a kind of series of reforms that have been instituted through different laws over the past 10 years. Some of those were written by former Governor Jerry Brown. He just yesterday told me he's putting $1 million into trying to defeat that measure. And advocates think that essentially in broad brushstrokes, what that measure would do is make it harder for many inmates to parole from state prison, and really easier in a lot of cases for prosecutors to send more people to jails and prisons. Critics of this proposal say that it would really roll back a lot of the progress California's made around lowering its prison population and focusing on rehabilitation and reentry over incarceration and kind of really harsh prison sentences. And so you really do see an interesting coalition of folks coming out against this, and in some ways an interesting coalition pushing it, because it's not just a partisan issue, as I mentioned.
Yeah, and let's hear what ex-Governor Jerry Brown had to say to you yesterday.
The only reason that some police unions have decided to fight it, and some of the DAs, they either are part of an enterprise that depends for its growth on more people being locked up, or they have this ideology that there can be no redemption, no improvement, that once a man commits one act or three or four acts, that is his whole essence forever. And everything we know about human beings is that they can change. Maybe not everybody, but certainly a good number of people.
So given these measures that we're seeing come out of the California legislature, do you see Black Lives Matter activists and their allies doubling down, or are they kind of taking a break and trying to sort of reassess the landscape here?
I think activists are kind of scattered in a way. I mean, I think that there's a lot of folks who have spent a lot of energy trying to push the legislature to do things. It's a slightly different coalition who is most involved at this point in fighting Prop 20 and the bail ballot measure. But I'm sort of interested to see how things play out over the next 60 days or so, because I do think that we've seen public opinion really shifting wildly this summer around Black Lives Matter and the protest. And it's really hard to tell kind of how everything happening nationally is going to impact these ballot measures. You know, we know that people, if they are confused or not sure, they tend to say no to things. But both sides in that Prop 20 debate, for example, claim that their polling shows them ahead. So who knows? And I think there's just and there's always the wild card, right, of this presidential race and the protest and kind of where things move, whether it be here or in other states.
Marisa Lagos is a politics correspondent at KQED News and co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. Thanks so much, Marisa.
I got my potato
on Radiolab,
and I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small Potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Pleasure.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanagopal in for Tanzina.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex.
Yes, people, let's talk about it. More specifically, sex during a pandemic. Even though many of us have largely stayed at home in recent months, that doesn't mean people have stopped seeking companionship. Here's the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, weighing in on the potential risks of meeting someone new in person.
you know, everybody has their own tolerance for risks, and it depends on the level of the interaction that you want to have. If you're looking for a friend, sit in a room, put a mask on, and, you know, chat a bit. If you want to go a little bit more intimate, well, then that's your choice regarding a risk.
That was Dr. Fauci speaking on Snapchat's Good Luck America back in April. We're also hearing from you about what the pandemic has meant for your sex lives at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, my name is Amy. I'm calling from Ferndale, Washington. You want to know how the pandemic has affected my sex life? What sex life? The kids are home every gosh darn minute of the day.
This is Mark Mannheimer, and I'm calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. Ugh, what sex life? As I live alone and obviously cannot have any kind of intimate contact, that really does not exist for me now.
Calling from Anchorage, Alaska, we have a system worked out now where I'm working from home due to COVID-19 distancing. Our two kiddos are at a daycare or a grandparent's house for school, and my husband has been able to come home for lunch and dessert.
Hey, this is Diana from Hot Springs, Arkansas, and COVID has totally messed up our sex life. We have a 17-year-old. He knows what's going on, and he's home all the time.
Debbie in Fort Lauderdale. How has the pandemic affected my sex life? Well, being in fear of your health and financial well-being is not a turn-on. I'll never believe a steamy sex scene in a disaster movie again.
And with us today to continue this conversation is Lisa Bonos, who writes about dating and relationships for The Washington Post. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've written about the etiquette of hooking up and how that's changed these past few months. Tell me about some of the main changes.
Yeah, well, like some of your callers just mentioned, a lot of people aren't seeing new partners right now. There's a lot of isolation, but some people are out there dating and just asking a lot of questions about their potential partners' lives right now. Who are you quarantining with? How strict is that? Are you wearing a mask when you're out? Things like that.
And these are the kinds of questions that perhaps in a previous era might have been seen as like just completely, you know, the kinds of things you would not talk about if you want to flirt with someone or, you know, or take it any further, correct?
For sure, for sure.
We're talking about this at the same time you've described this term of sex recession happening more broadly, correct?
Yes. So big surveys in 2019 found that especially young people, 18 to 29, about a quarter of them hadn't had sex in the past year. You know, we're already going before the pandemic, a lot of people were not getting intimate that often. And now you have these extra difficulties. So a lot of people are experiencing even more celibacy or more extreme celibacy.
So how are people actually meeting their potential hookup partners during the pandemic, given all these restrictions?
Yeah. Well, I spoke to a 25-year-old man who actually met someone on a Zoom happy hour. He describes it to me as like, I thought this one square was cute, you know, and later finds out that she's a friend of a friend and started texting with her. But people are also meeting on dating apps. Dating apps are reporting larger traffic numbers, that more people are on there. Friends are introducing friends to one another. Yesterday I heard from a woman who's starting like a, she just is, she's a normal person, not a professional matchmaker, and she started a pool where she sets people up for phone calls all over the country or even the world, and she's been doing that for 600 people recently.
Do you think that as this goes on and on, that's perhaps changing people's willingness to just take risks?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, is pairing on a conversation with someone long distance, is that a risk or is that being safe? You know, I think our notion of what a risk is right now is changing. You know, some young people that I spoke to for my reporting have said because they're so stressed out and so lonely and the isolation is so extreme, they're more willing to take a risk physically because they just really want to connect with someone. So seeing things all over the board.
I mean, some of this feels very new. At the same time, if you look back at, say, life in the 80s, especially if you're gay or lesbian or LGBTQ community has a much longer sort of history of kind of like thinking through some of these issues. Are you seeing different dimensions of this when it comes to members of the LGBTQ community?
Yeah, well, when I speak to LGBTQ daters, they often talk about already having these really personal conversations about what your health is like before getting physical, right? That gay daters on dating apps will ask, like, when was the last time you were tested for sexually transmitted infections? Or are you taking PrEP, you know, the prophylactic drug to prevent mm-hmm. HIV infection? And so a lot of daters are already used to having these really intense personal conversations. And so just to add on top of that, like, hey, how have you been quarantining? You know, what's your pod like, is just a natural extension of that.
I mean, a lot of this has to do with just the basic stress, economic stress, right? And health risks. And I mean, you know, the basic health risk of whether or not we're going to get sick on any given day. I mean, that does a lot to just the issue of desire, doesn't it?
For sure. When I spoke to a sexuality researcher at the Kinsey Institute, he talked about how these are such anxious times and you know, very stressful, and people are worried about their livelihoods, and that definitely tamps down desire. And so you get that in couples and for singles.
Before we go, I mean, one of the things that this seems to have opened up is just the fact that a lot of people are alone. They're by themselves. They have to figure out just how to find pleasure on their own. I mean, the New York City Department of Health somewhat famously released a list of safe sex practices this spring, leading with the line, quote, you are your safest sex partner. So do you see a lot more people talking openly about masturbation?
You do see that. You also see people trying forms of virtual intimacy for the first time. I speak to daters who talk about, you know, trying sexting for the first time or cyber sex, and there's all kinds of ways to try that out. So some people are, you know, and that is the safest sex you can have as well.
That's right. And I guess some people are actually discovering that perhaps there is romance to be found in the cold grid of a Zoom conversation. So, you know, I'm curious about something you've written about, which is the velocity of relationships during COVID-19. How has that changed?
Yeah, well, some singles are spending several weeks or months getting to know someone over the phone or video chat before meeting in person, or they're going on socially distant dates and not going into each other's apartments for several dates. And it's really made people get to know each other better before either meeting up in person or getting physical with each other.
And some people you've spoken to, I mean, experts, think that this is a good thing. This is a healthier thing.
Yeah, no, experts often mention the fact that people are getting to know each other at a deeper level is helping those singles form stronger connections, which before, if you've ever been on a dating app, you know, you have to make decisions within seconds whether to swipe right or left to discard someone or say yes. And then those quick decisions were also translated into first dates, but not a lot of second dates, or quick messages and not meeting up in person. So when it's harder to make these connections, people are spending more time with each connection that they do have, trying to really get to know the person before saying yes or no.
Do you think most of these things are just temporary and last only as long as this pandemic lasts? Or do you think some of these are what we're seeing, some potentially long-lasting changes to people's relationships and sex lives in this country?
Yeah, it's really hard to know, but I sure hope that at least that notion of getting to know someone on a deeper level before deciding whether or not to pursue a relationship with them, I hope that one sticks, and that, because the daters that I'm speaking to really are finding utility in that, in getting to know each other. I mean, it is also frustrating sometimes, especially if people are quarantining far away from each other, or they're, you know, staying with older relatives or lots of roommates. There's definitely some frustration right now, but I'm hoping that there's some good things that come out of this that do stick.
I mean, I guess, do you think that people who might have not been in a relationship for a while are deciding now that they've been too picky, that they need to, like, be a little more accommodating, if you will? I mean, I feel like I'm using all these, like, you know, old man terms, you know, but I mean, this is an ongoing conversation about, like, you know, when do you settle? When do you just have to, you know, make compromises? And is this, do you think, a moment when these kinds of issues are really being brought out?
They are. It's hard to say whether that will stick as well. But, you know, one couple that stands out to me is I have been talking to this couple where the woman hadn't been in a relationship for over a decade, and she struck up a phone conversation relationship with someone 3,000 miles away, and they got so close that she drove across the country from New York to California to pick up and meet her new boyfriend for the first time and bring him back with her to New York, and now they've been quarantining together for months, and that was the only way they could see each other. He couldn't just hop on a plane for a weekend, right? They had to make this big decision: are we doing this, or we're not, or are we not? And they decided they were doing it. So, you know, just as many daters are deciding, I'm going to sit this one out. I'll wait until the pandemic is over. So,
wow. I mean, that's a kind of like old-fashioned, almost antiquated idea of romance you kind of forgot existed anymore, it seems like.
Exactly, and we're still capable of it, apparently.
Apparently, yeah. Lisa Definitely. Bonos writes about dating and relationships for The Washington Post. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Chris from Richmond, California. My wife and I got pregnant on the second week of the shelter-in-place order, and now we know about six other couples that are in the same situation.
Hi, this is Liz from Florida. I'm hearing so many stories about people having so much sex all the time on quarantine, and that's just not my experience. The stress and anxiety and depression that has come with this experience has wreaked havoc on mine and my partner's libidos. We haven't had sex in months.
This is Mark Mannheimer, and I'm calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. Ugh, what sex life? As I live alone and obviously cannot have any kind of intimate contact, that really does not exist for me now. I, in essence, do not have a sex life.
Hi, this is Leah from Somerset. As far as the pandemic affecting my sex life, at the beginning of the pandemic, I had sex a lot more out of boredom and because we were stuck at home together and had lots of time. But as it has dragged on, our underlying stress and anxiety have increased, and we have become less intimate less often.
Hi, this is John Abbott calling from Hopewell, New Jersey. My significant other lives an hour's drive away, which never bothered us over the past 3.5 years. While we do miss each other on every level, we also recognize the importance of intimacy. But we agreed that intimacy is always worth the wait and not worth the risk of a potentially fatal illness.
This is The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think, and thanks for listening.
This week, the Trump administration rolled back an Obama-era Environmental Protection Agency regulation requiring coal plants to treat wastewater for toxic chemicals. The move has the potential to affect the water supply for over 1 million people in the U.S. who live near coal plants. At the same time, coal industry leaders who had opposed the rule for being too costly are welcoming the rollback. For more on this, we're joined by Emily Holden, environment reporter for The Guardian U.S. Emily, glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, how could this rule actually change the quality of drinking water for communities that live near coal plants?
Well, power plants are the largest industrial source of toxic wastewater pollution around the country. And essentially what the EPA has done is say if a coal plant is planning to shut down by 2028, they don't have to comply with these new rules to treat wastewater at all. And if they aren't, they can have more time and more flexibility to do so.
So just to be clear, does this mean that they weren't actually complying anyways?
The rule that was implemented or that was written by the Obama administration had not yet gone into effect. So no, they were not.
Okay. And that's because once the Trump administration came in, they managed to sort of push back compliance, correct?
Essentially, but in the rule from the Obama administration would have had them beginning in 2018 start to use the most up-to-date technology and finalize their updates by 2023. Now they're going to have until 2025.
Got it. So let's talk about these toxins that could really affect people. What are these toxins and how exactly do they affect people's health?
We're talking mainly about heavy metals. So the waste that's coming from coal plants, they have these sort of air filters, what are called scrubbers on them, that coal plant operators have to clean out, and they do that with water. And so you have toxic metals that end up in that water, arsenic, mercury, selenium, lead, and things that are linked with a broad range of health issues, both because they end up in drinking water and because they accumulate in fish that people eat from their local rivers and lakes.
And there's also something called coal ash, right?
That's right. So there's another kind of waste from coal plants that is essentially what's left over after burning the coal that you can't burn any further to make electricity. And so the coal plant operators clean that out with water as well. And they usually end up putting that in a pit or sort of pond that can leach into the groundwater as well.
Now, the Trump administration says the rule will actually cut pollution down more than the Obama rule. Is there any truth in that?
They're claiming that they would be able to cut more pollution, yes, but the way that they're able to do that is by counting many of the efforts that they have made voluntary for the coal industry. And so if they were just to count the things that they're requiring the coal plants to do, they would probably be getting very different numbers.
I guess basically you're saying that this is all just kind of like an honor system under the Trump administration.
No, there are some requirements that are actually mandatory, but what EPA, the Trump EPA, is counting is they're saying that we assume that 30% of coal plants are just going to get the better technology, even though we're not requiring them to do so, and then they're counting those pollution reductions.
And how many coal plants are we talking about? I mean, this is an industry that is essentially on the decline, correct?
Yes, coal has really been in decline for decades now, really, for a mix of reasons, in part because, in addition to polluting the water, it is also a large source of pollution for the air and emits carbon dioxide, which is the major climate pollutant. So you've seen a lot of electricity companies switching over to cheaper natural gas or renewable power. But what we're talking about is a million Americans that live within 3 miles of a coal plant where this water is being discharged. They're around the country. And we know that poor Americans and people of color are much more likely to live near these plants and also near other polluting industries where they're having a bigger cumulative impact from all the pollution that they live with.
Emily, this is just the latest regulatory measure that's gone in industry's favor. Have environmentalists had any success under this administration?
I think the Trump administration sought out to roll back essentially every major environment and climate regulation that we saw from the Obama administration, and then even more that were older than that. So the environmental advocacy groups have challenged a lot of these rules, and they've had some major successes, but a lot of the court processes are still ongoing. And the key thing to remember here is that the regulatory process takes a long time to start. It takes a long time to roll back. But really what's happened here is, like, even if there's another administration, a Joe Biden administration, there's been a major delay in climate efforts and environmental protection efforts in the U.S.
What would you say have been the biggest successes on the part of environmental justice groups?
They've been able to halt some rules from taking effect, and they have made some challenges to say that EPA has not essentially followed the protocols that they're supposed to, or looked at all the science that they're supposed to, gotten enough feedback, and been able to stop some things from moving forward.
Now, as you said, the coal industry has been declining for years. Is that why these companies have been asking for regulatory relief?
Yes. President Trump came into office, he campaigned on putting coal workers back to work. From the very beginning, he had all industries seeking regulatory relief, as they call it, from the agencies. So it's not just coal. It's the oil and gas industry, the chemicals industry. All of them have gotten largely what they've sought from the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there any actual sign that these efforts are helping coal industry, or, help it bring back jobs?
These rollbacks to public health protections and safety protections, they will probably give, you know, some coal plants a little bit more of a runway before they shut down. But ultimately, they're not going to change the trajectory that the industry is on, which is still a very steep decline, because power companies just don't want to burn coal anymore. They have other alternatives, and it's essentially a matter of time until this industry continues to be phased out.
The technology that's used to treat this water and make it safe for drinking, is it really expensive?
So I spoke with the woman who helped write this rule under the Obama administration, Betsy Sutherland, and she said it's not expensive at all, and it has improved a lot since the rule was initially written. And so that's why she says that the technology that EPA is assuming that some coal plants will voluntarily use is what should be required. If it's available and it's inexpensive, it's something that they can do. She says that it's something that they should do.
Andrew Wheeler, the head of the EPA, is a former coal lobbyist. What was his role in crafting this rule change?
So Wheeler has agreed to a number of issues that he won't work on that relate to his previous job, his previous clients. But the concern with that is that he's still over the agency. And these rules basically say that, you know, he won't meet alone with the particular people that he worked with. He won't work on rules that would specifically benefit them, but he can be involved in rules that help an entire industry. So really, he oversees everything that's happening at the agency, and he certainly had a hand in this rollback as well.
And, I mean, are there other regulations the Trump administration has implemented that specifically threaten drinking water?
Yes, probably the biggest one is a change to a rule called the Waters of the United States rule, which the Obama administration wrote to expand the waters that were protected by federal regulation. So looking at the bodies of water that feed into the bigger rivers and lakes. And so now the Trump administration has changed that to say that those bodies of water are not subject to federal rules. And so what a lot of experts I talk to say is that that means that you're going to have more industry pollution coming into those smaller waterways, and it will be harder for drinking water systems to get that out of our water before they provide it to us through our taps.
Emily, besides, I guess, the utilities and the industry leaders who are benefiting from this, do you see that there is sort of a political benefit in terms of the Trump base, in terms of are these issues that really seem to appeal to them, these pro-industry sort of measures?
That's a complicated question, largely because I think a lot of Trump supporters would say that they want kind of less government interference in American life. But we also know that Americans largely support environmental protection, and they largely support climate action. And this is the opposite of that. This is helping an industry that we know needs to be phased out in order to meet what is a rapidly approaching and like pretty stringent goal. We've already had a degree Celsius of warming. We're on track for 3 degrees Celsius of warming, and that's something that's going to be catastrophic for American life.
Sure. I mean, are there any other significant changes to climate policy that you've been witnessing over the course of this pandemic?
A lot of them are coming before the pandemic. So we know that the Trump administration is rolling back rules that would have sought to sort of transform the electricity sector and move away from coal plants, and also rules that would require vehicles to get more miles per gallon so they don't have to use as much gasoline. But also during the pandemic, we've seen the Trump administration provide large payments to coal and oil and gas companies as part of its Paycheck Protection Program. Not something that's been available to all industries, but we know that those industries that might have already been suffering got an additional boost from that money during this economic downturn.
Emily Holden is the environment reporter for The Guardian U.S. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for being with me. It's been great to be back here with you and with the great team that helps make this show possible. Our board operators are Debbie Daughtry and Vince Fairchild, and Jake Howitt is our director and sound designer. Line producing was Jackie Martin. Alexander Bautie is our senior producer, and Ethan Oberman stepped in for her this week. His crew is Jose Oliveras, Jason Toreski, Meg Dalton, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and Asher Stockler. Polly Arungu is our digital editor, David Gable is our executive assistant, and Lee Hill is the executive producer, the big boss, the head cheese. By the way, speaking of, did you know he was from Wisconsin? We've been thrilled to be on Wisconsin Public Radio this week and going forward. Welcome to the Takeaway family. Glad to have you with us, just like all of you out there anywhere you listen. Thanks as always for listening. Amy Walter is with you tomorrow. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway.